Welcome back to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. The Lansing State Journal reports today that two American brothers who once lived here in Lansing were arrested 2 days ago in Tunisia in connection with terrorism charges. I'm looking at Christopher Haxel and Matt Mencarini's treatment of this story in today's Lansing State Journal. Tunisia Live, an English-language news organization in the North African country, cited unnamed Tunisian officials in reporting that the men were detained on suspicion of encouraging terrorism and campaigning for the introduction of Islamic law. Other Tunisian outlets later reported that the brothers were released from custody on Wednesday but must remain available to officials while the investigation continues. Matt and Christopher at the LSJ report that the brothers owned a Lansing home in the 900 block of Vine Street as recently as January, according to property records. Both men have faced criminal charges in Ingham County, court records show. We will keep an eye on that story as it continues to unfold. Earlier this year, a group that advocates for Michigan municipalities relaunched an effort to better fund cities and local units of government. According to compilations by the Michigan Municipal League using data from the House Fiscal Agency, Michigan has diverted a total of $7.5 billion in revenue-sharing money from local governments since 2002. The Michigan Municipal League Save My City effort focuses on what it and many others say are the negative consequences of those cuts and similar forces in play. So 7 months after the relaunch and after many discussions around the state, where is the league's effort? Are they changing mind? What are they hearing? What have they learned? Tony Mangini is the Associate Executive Director and COO of the Michigan Municipal League. Welcome, Tony.
Thanks for having me.
The Save My City effort relaunched back in March. We had you on at that time. Mm-hmm. We had you on Current State at that time. And you and your colleagues have been traveling the state ever since, talking about what you and many others allege is our broken model for municipal revenue. What impact do you feel you're having in this effort?
Well, it's certainly something that is being discussed a lot more than it has been a number of years. We've had over 130 articles published around the state, spoken to about 30-plus groups around the state trying to get this message out, because what we think is important for everybody to understand, this isn't a city issue or a Lansing issue. It's an issue that affects people. It affects businesses, because if their local governments can't provide the services that they need, it affects them. And so we're trying to get people to understand and put it in their terms why they should care, why it matters, and encouraging them to have those conversations with their legislators as well. So, and it's starting, I think, to have an impact, and discussions for the first time, I think, are starting to take place.
What's the mood like out there as you travel the state and have these discussions? What kinds of things are stakeholders saying about this landscape in terms of mood? What kind of mood signals are you picking up here?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think the first, as I do this presentation, I think it starts off with a surprise, because we have a pretty strong economy right now in a general sense, and people would assume that cities must be doing well since they probably on a personal level feel like things are improving. And as you start to lay out how Michigan's municipal finance model works and they realize that that's just not the case for the local governments, then that our general impression has been, and the mood has been, that they're supportive of trying to take a new look at this.
What are the most common symptoms you're hearing about that a city or township might be having that's facing these kinds of financial pressures? Is this playing out on the ground?
Yes, yeah, so let me answer it this way. So we already talked about revenue sharing. And so for the vast majority of cities in Michigan, their two biggest sources of revenue are property taxes and revenue sharing. Property taxes, usually about half. Revenue sharing, somewhere 25-30% is typically what you see. So revenue sharing, as we've talked about, has had some pretty major diversions away from that, $7.5 billion. And when you start looking at it on a community-by-community basis, for example, I just spoke in Flint a couple nights ago, and they've lost over $60 million. I was in Troy yesterday. They've lost almost $24 million. So you can start to see the impact that has on a community. You can sort of put some context to it and think about what you might want to do. But the other one, then, is property taxes. And Michigan State has done a study, and they rank Michigan's property tax system to be the second most restrictive in the nation, second to only Colorado. And so what's happened with that is coming out of the Great Recession, where we saw significant reductions in taxable values for people's homes, businesses, and the like, the way our systems are built is we are now stuck at those lower levels. And so on the whole, Michigan's taxable values in 2014 were at 2005 levels. And they can only grow at inflation or 5%, whichever is less. And last year, inflation was less than 1%.
Yeah.
So you can imagine how difficult it is to provide services. And when you think of some of our most negatively impacted, and this number is fresh in my head just because I spoke there the other day, but Flint, in 2016's taxable value is lower than it was in 2000. And I'd like to tell you how far I have to go back before I get to that number, but the state's records only go back to the year 2000, and it's still higher than it is in 2016.
I shouldn't be surprised to hear that, but it's still kind of stunning to understand that. 16 years later, taxable values are still under what they were. Correct me if I'm wrong, Tony, but it appears that improving municipalities' financial standing is kind of like a three-legged stool, or that appears to be the approach you're taking here.
Absolutely.
One leg is state revenue sharing. Another would be what you just alluded to, more options for municipalities to generate more of their own revenue. And finally, third, cost cutting. Is it generally accurate to look at it that way, or am I leaving something out?
Well, we also think we can think more structurally as well. So the three legs, as we sort of define them, is revenue in general. We sort of put that all in one bucket. The cost, absolutely. And structure is another thing we could talk about. So let me talk about those, if I could, just
please.
Quickly. Cost, for example, we have an incredible OPEB problem, which is retiree health care, essentially, other post-employment benefits in Michigan. And we did a study of our 300 biggest members, and that unfunded obligation was $6.5 billion. And it's not uniform across the state. On average, it's only funded about 18%. Now, most people think about pensions being a problem. We think OPEB's the real deal. So one of the things we've been talking about is there's better ways, we think, to deliver that benefit so folks could still have a good health care and retirement that isn't going to break the backs of communities. There are communities spending upwards of 30% of their general operating budget to provide for legacy costs. That's unsustainable. So taking a look at costs like that, and that's going to require help from Lansing, and we've been very forward about that. But there's opportunities there. When we think about structure, think about the infrastructure in this state. We have expanded infrastructure by an incredible amount, but we haven't added people. And so we're asking the same number of people in Michigan to support significantly more infrastructure. And then we wonder why there's not enough money to support that infrastructure. It's because, again, when you expand it without increasing demand, so we sort of abandoned the infrastructure we built. So if we thought differently about the structure, how we deliver services, you know, maybe incent folks to use the infrastructure that we have or fully leverage the infrastructure we have before we build new. There's opportunities there as well. And then on the revenue side, we talked about the two big ones, but there's other things that could be looked at, local option and other things.
Tony Mangini is the Associate Executive Director and COO of the Michigan Municipal League. We're talking about the league's Save My City effort, which relaunched back in March. They are traveling the state here discussing what ails Michigan's municipalities here in a financial way and revenue sharing. The shrinkage of state revenue sharing is a big part of this equation. Isn't it essential that you make headway in the legislature?
Absolutely.
And are you doing that? Do you feel like you're making progress there?
Well, we do, actually. I said it's open with that. People are actually talking about this. This has been a conversation that there probably hasn't been good, honest conversation for a long time. The administration has been open to having these conversations. The governor's office indicated this is an issue that they're paying attention to and I think plan to, in some form or fashion, deal with as the balance of his term. We've had our folks here in Lansing have had lots of conversations with different legislators who maybe don't agree with every aspect of it, but different folks have interest in different things. And we're starting to have some meaningful conversations about that, which I think is obviously a big first step because that really hasn't happened for some time. If our cities fail, we all fail. And I think people are starting to realize that this relationship needs to be more equitable.
I reached out yesterday to Gideon DeSandro. Gideon is the staff chief for House Speaker Kevin Cotter, and I'm trying to understand where the Republican caucus, in the House at least, stands on this issue. And he responded, quote, "I think you can look at the last couple of budgets to see our position. After some lean years, funding for locals is up. So is funding for local school districts and state support for emergency services like police and fire." It is true, isn't it, that in recent years, statutory revenue sharing is indeed going up, correct?
I disagree with that a little bit. Revenue sharing in general has gone up slightly in the last few years. Much of that is due to the constitutional increase, because there's two buckets for revenue sharing. There's constitutional and statutory. And so a couple of those years there were not statutory increases, but the constitutional. So overall revenue sharing went up.
Okay. I might have had it backwards.
Yeah. So,
then.
But what they fail to recognize is we are at historically low levels. So the fact that if your historical review is going to only be the last couple of years, yes, revenue sharing has inched upwards, but we're at the bottom of the valley as we're having that conversation. This has been in a decline since 2002. So this, I want to be clear, this is not about this administration or this legislature. This has been going on since the early 2000s. It's something we've been talking about for some time. But we're nowhere near the levels that were promised to local government when we did this switch back when Proposal A passed.
So, Tony, if you could craft legislation, if you could craft a measure and get it signed, get it through the House, get it through the Senate, and get it signed as specifically as possible, what would that measure call for?
Well, I'll lay a little bit of reality over that, because I know they don't have. So right now we're pushing around $700 million of shortfall from what should be if we were fully funding the formula. I realize there's not $700 million of money floating around the budget right now. But I do think we got into this over time. I think we could start making headway going out over time. I think if we could phase in over some reasonable number of years, real increases, not, you know, 2 or 3% increases, real increases into that, that would be important. The second thing that we have completely abandoned because of the way the cuts initially started is there's really no formula right now. The formula for distributing revenue sharing used to take into account a number of factors, how big the place was, the type of community they were, their relative tax effort. In other words, their ability to generate revenues off the values they have. So revenue sharing used to help level the playing field for communities that maybe don't have the revenue raising capacity because their properties aren't worth as much. So we'd have to also incorporate that back into that. And if we could get there, I think that'd be a huge step forward.
But this would be statutory.
Yes.
A bump in statutory revenue sharing. Mm-hmm. The constitutional is baked in the cake.
Is that
correct?
Yep. And the constitutional is just a straight per capita. It makes no distinction between, you know, a community's role in their region or size or any of those factors I just talked about. And those pots used to be about even. Constitutional, and in fact, statutory used to be bigger than constitutional. And now statutory is $200 million-ish and constitutional is like nine, I think.
A historical question here. How was this cutting rationalized here over the years? How was it justified?
Well, the honest answer is they put their interests ahead of local governments. So if you go all the way back to when it first started, I think
they put the legislature,
the administration and the legislatures at those times. So I'll go all the way back to, I think Engler was the first one to cut it. So I'm okay. Painting everyone with both parties. I'll throw the rock.
It happened under Jennifer Granholm
as well.
It happened
throughout Jennifer Granholm's administration. And I think there was a belief early on that this problem was temporary, that our economic issue, their budgetary issues were temporary. And this was going to be, we'll just take a little something off the top. And it wasn't significant at first. So even local government kind of grumbled a little bit and said, well, you know, this will come back. And it was always next year we're going to get them. And next year never came. And in fact, it worsened and it worsened. So when they were placing budgetary priorities, they said, you know, look, the state bureaucracy is going to win out over the delivery of local services, police, fire, parks, and the like. And they've pushed that down to us. And a little bit more historical perspective, if you go back to when we shifted to all sales tax revenue sharing, that goes back to Proposal A. You know, most people think about that as a school funding measure when we added 2 cents to the sales tax or they think about it as that component, that limited growth on your particular home in terms of increases. But there was another part of it. If you were a local government person, we used to get a piece of all the different revenue sources at the state: income tax, sales tax, intangibles tax, inventory reimbursement. There were all these little pots of money. And one of the things that the state said as part of the sales pitch, if you will, to get local government to support that change was, we'll give you a bigger piece of the sales tax because that's a more stable source of revenue and you can rely on that because it's very difficult for local government to handle fluctuations. Made sense. And they were absolutely right. Throughout the entirety of the recession, that was a very stable source of revenue. Very minor dips, very minor increases. It's a very stable source. But what they didn't do is absorb it. They took that stable source of revenue away from local government and shoved their problem down to us.
Tony Mangini is the Associate Executive Director and COO of the Michigan Municipal League. We've been talking about the financial landscape for local units of government across Michigan. He is an advocate of increased revenue sharing at the state level. Tony, thanks for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Coming up on Current State, rescuing a victim of human trafficking is always an emergency. But experts say one of the hardest places to spot those victims is in a hospital emergency room. One healthcare organization in Genesee County will use a state grant to develop better ways of identifying and treating human trafficking victims. We'll talk with two members of the Genesis Health System on the way. Baseballs autographed by famous major leaguers and other celebrities are often highly sought after by fans and collectors and can sometimes become very valuable objects, but it's not every day you hear of a baseball that's been autographed by legendary American industrialist Henry Ford. A couple in New Jersey found such a baseball in their attic, and Henry Ford's signature wasn't the only one on the ball, by the way. Joining us by phone to tell us more about this rare find, Josh Evans, the founder of Leland's.com, which is auctioning the baseball off tomorrow in New Jersey. Hi, Josh.
How are you, sir?
I am well. What was your reaction when you heard baseball signed by Henry Ford?
I was floored, and I saw it in person, which was great. We were at the National Sports Collectors Convention this year, which was in Atlantic City, and this couple came up and they said, "Well, we found this, in our attic, and we really don't know what it is or what it's worth or anything like that." And I looked at it and I immediately recognized the signature of Henry Ford. They knew it was Henry Ford, of course, but they didn't know if it was authentic or whether it was a joke or what. I also recognized the autograph of Ralph DePalma, who was a great race car driver, and I found out later worked for Ford. And it was pretty amazing, and I was really blown away. And my enthusiasm for it, because I'm interested in those type of things, things that cross over from baseball to historical or popular, really has a great interest to me. So, I just, they actually walked around. I told them that what it was worth, or what it could be worth, $5,000 or $10,000. And they were going to walk around and talk to some other people. And they literally came back like a minute later and said, no, we're going to just go with you. We like you. You really have enthusiasm for it and you're really excited about it. So we got it, and I was really happy.
All set to go tomorrow here. We'll point out to our listeners, too, that you have been dealing in antiques since the tender age of 8. You went on to become the first legitimate sports memorabilia appraiser in America. How do you go about authenticating autographs when people bring you items like this?
Well, the first thing is instinct. You have this little voice in your head that either if you must listen to it, though. It's easy to kind of push it out. But I try to always listen to that instinct, and it just tells me right off, yes or no. And then you need to kind of go a little further with it. You can look at, you know, exemplars, meaning examples of other autographs of the same person that you know are authentic. And but I get a lot just from the look of it, you know, not the signature itself, but what it's on and how that looks. But, you know, someone can just take an old piece of paper or an old ball and they can put an autograph on it. But there's a relationship that the autograph has to the thing it's on, you know, to the content. And there has to be like almost, well, one of the industry terms is knitting, where when something's on something for a really long time, it has a different look to it than something that's been put on fresh.
Clarify for us, Josh, here. I guess Ford was a big fan of baseball. How many balls do we know how many baseballs he autographed?
Well, the only ones that have ever been seen are at this exhibit that was done at Ford, and it was the safety glass anniversary of safety glass, and it was in 1933, and they did like a display. And Ford, I guess there were children coming to this, maybe a school or something like that, and they went through the trouble of having custom-made baseballs with the logo of the exhibit, the logo of the V8 engine, and he signed them. Now, it was interesting. We thought that this was the only one, or could be the only one, and a collector came forward who was really a Ford collector, but he had a little mini collection within his collection of stuff from Ford that was baseball related or related to both Ford and baseball. And he said, look, I have one too, and I also have this ball unsigned. And we were blown away. It was great. And he was nice enough to say, would you like to see the photograph of the exhibit and Ford signing these baseballs? And I was like, yeah, great. And we saw the actual, we have it actually on our website with the item, which is Leland's.com, by the way. And it's a picture of Henry Ford with a bunch of kids around him, and he's signing these baseballs.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic.
1933 event, and it's at Leland's.com. What are the odds that the ball he's holding is the ball that you're auctioning?
Well, you know, it's funny. I don't think it wasn't like, you know, there was a million people there. So, I mean, it's probably like 1 in 20 or something like that.
Okay.
But I know that the photo's good enough and the story and everything. It's just, it's great. It's very rare that you find things match up so well. But when, you know, with the internet and, you know, the communication out there, it's great because all these kinds of things come out. And what's interesting is you think, oh, well, all this stuff comes out because, you know, because of the market and, you know, everything is now just so much more common. Well, it's interesting. There are things that are common in the field, you know, whether it's baseball cards or autographs or uniforms or any of the other things that we collect. But the really rare things, the really good things, those things, you realize how rare they are and how special they are. So it works. It's a two-edged sword, so it works both ways.
Josh Evans is the founder of Leland's.com. Tomorrow his firm is auctioning off a baseball that may be the only baseball ever signed and authenticated to be legitimate, signed by Henry Ford. The other notable autograph on this ball, there's a number of other ones, but one of them is Ralph DePalma. You alluded to him earlier. Great racing legend. He won the 1915 Indy 500 and lots more races. Tell us more about him.
Well, DePalma was really one of the giants. And when he got older, you know, and he couldn't race anymore because, as you said, he won the Indy in 1915. And this was now, you know, 18 years later, and he went to work for Ford, and he developed different cars and products, and he was very valuable. And it's also signed by some of the other executives of Ford. And, you know, it's interesting. The fact that it's signed by the executives And by De Palma, you know, because the other ball is just signed by Ford that we know of. What's interesting about that is it was likely then signed for not a kid but an adult, because someone that probably worked there or and appreciated who these other men were and how important. One of them was a real groundbreaking exec whose name escapes me at the moment. But it was likely done for an insider, someone who really appreciated who the other people were.
We've just got a few seconds. Josh, how much do you expect the ball to go for tomorrow?
It's roughly at like $4,000, but you know it could easily go for 10 or 20. But we'll see. And there's another 1,000 lots of really quality, high-end sports memorabilia in this auction, everything from Pete Rose's Rookie of the Year award to a uniform worn in the last World Series that the Cubs were in 1945. It's really exciting. So if you go to Leland's.com, you could still register to bid, and you can bid at home in the safety of your own home, or the safety glass of your own home, if I may say so.
We've been talking about a baseball autographed and authenticated to have been autographed by legendary American industrialist Henry Ford. A couple in New Jersey found the ball in their attic, and tomorrow it's auctioned off by our guest, Josh Evans of Leland's.com in New Jersey. Thanks, Josh.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
Coming up on Current State, the Audio Air Force Radio Theater Troupe is bringing a double bill to the Robin Theater this Halloween weekend, but in addition to the classic Dracula, founder Dave Downing and company aren't taking the other half of the program lightly.
Chickenheart, I don't know how seriously they took it back in 1938, but we're going to put a lot of cheese on it, making it like a B-movie.
We'll sit in on the rehearsal and speak with the troupe's founder, Dave Downing. That's coming up this hour on Current State. Guitarist Pat Zelenka there on a recent visit to Current State on a Live Music Friday. That's Chitlins Con Carne, an old Kenny Burrell tune that's been covered by Buddy Guy and the late Stevie Ray Vaughan. Tomorrow we welcome Alex Mendenhall to Studio S, Lansing-based soul and folk singer-songwriter who's launching his first full-length album called Into the Hinterland. Alex Mendenhall tomorrow on Live Music Friday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Human trafficking is the fastest growing illegal activity in the world that exploits untold numbers of people for sexual slavery or forced labor. The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services recently awarded grants to three social service organizations to combat the problem. The Genesis Health Foundation in Genesee County will spend $50,000 to teach personnel in its ER how to identify and treat victims of human trafficking. Recently, I spoke with two employees of the Genesis system about the grant and about the larger problem of human trafficking. Dr. Alan Jansen is the Director of Emergency Medicine Residency, and Nicholas Evans is its Vice President of Business. I first asked Dr. Jansen how widespread human trafficking is in Michigan.
Well, that's part of the problem, Mark. Even though we know it's a huge problem, we have a really hard time of getting a handle on exactly what those numbers are. That's primarily because of a lack of education, a lack of identification, and a lack of a solid reporting system where there's a central reporting system, I should say, where all these cases, when they're identified, actually funnel through. So that's part of the issue. We do know from estimates that there's probably about 100,000 newly enslaved people every year in the United States. That's a huge number.
Do we know much about the ages of the people being enslaved?
We have a pretty good idea. The entry age is somewhere between 12 and 16. A lot of studies suggest that it's probably in the area of the age of 14-year-olds. So very young.
And you have a unique perspective on this crisis. You're not just an emergency medicine physician, but you're also a reserve officer in the Oakland County Sheriff's Department. Can you shed any light, please, on how you've seen this tragedy from both of those angles, both as a physician and a law enforcement officer?
I certainly have a unique perspective in the fact that I, as others, have made it a personal vendetta, if you will, to get out there and spread the word. Over the last 4 years or so, I've lectured and done presentations at both the national, state, and regional level, right down to going to churches around the area when I'm invited to try to educate the community. So I have a personal interest in it to help eradicate it, help educate people to identify it. In particular, people, there's three main groups that it's really, really important that we educate. One are medical professionals. The second would be law enforcement. And the third would be those in the education system. And the reason why those three groups are so unique is that these are people that have a high potential of coming in contact with people, with victims rather, while they're actively enslaved. And so if we're trained to identify key features, if we're trained to think about it, and we can start to identify them, we're really in a unique position to help these people.
Nick Evans, I want to come to you. Did Genesis Health Foundation apply for the state grant because there is an acute human trafficking situation in Genesee County? How would you characterize the situation in Genesee County?
There is an acute situation in Genesee County, and a lot of that actually, it turns out that we are a very central recruiting ground for the recruitment of the young people that Dr. Jansen was talking about, but also we are a faith-based hospital, and part of our mission and vision is to seek to serve the underserved and those who are vulnerable in this community. And so really this came by way of that we were in the process of establishing a funding campaign for SANE, which is Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Program in our ED, which we have a training site that we use as a resource for this area. And then through beginning to work with the state of Michigan, it was highlighted to us that this work was also going on and that there was an opportunity for us, if you will, to design and put in place a best practice, which is kind of our DNA of trying to be innovative in introducing new programs. So we were kind of guided to that. We applied for it, and it really was the goal was to develop, implement, and then evaluate existing hospital protocols, and then use that as a means to go forward in identifying and then treating and then connecting human trafficking victims with community resources and assisting, as Dr. Jansen said, law enforcement with being successful then in the prosecution of those who victimized and trafficked those individuals. But it was really to just engage this community even one level beyond healthcare. And that was in really meeting the needs of the vulnerable individuals in this community that are being taken advantage of or maybe taken advantage to help protect them and advocate on their behalf.
Alan Jansen, back to you. Help us understand how these young people in particular become trafficked in the first place.
Well, you know, that's an entire hour and a half lecture, but I'll tell you, this is not some accident. This is organized. This is an organized, orchestrated business worldwide, multi-billion-dollar business. Many of these victims are identified based on their risk factors. They're recruited, actually, into this. They don't even know that it's happening, and once they figure it out, it's too late. And once you get trapped in this system, it's almost impossible for these kids to get out.
Nick Evans, Michigan now requires healthcare workers to receive training in human trafficking as part of their licensing process. This is part of a fairly new law just passed in January. What does this training consist of?
It really is going back to teaching them how to identify and to know what they're looking for. Interestingly, nationally, I think the number is about 87.7% of individuals in the human trafficking trade or those victims were through a healthcare facility of one type or another during any given year. And of those, 63% of them actually probably came through an emergency department. What is critically important to us is to really give to our staff and to both our primary care physicians as well as our specialists and other individuals working within the hospital the tools they need so that it's not just a vague happen chance they notice something, but so that they know specifically what they're looking for and are equipped then once they identify that they have the protocols in place so that they can do something to hopefully intervene in that process.
What is the most common sign?
And I would defer to Dr. Jansen on that as kind of the subject expert.
I don't really think there is a most common sign. It's a constellation of things that come together, and by being aware, you'll pick up on these things. These victims are subject to a horribly violent lifestyle. So being in tune to abusive patterns, being attuned to specific injuries, being attuned to who's with the victim when they come into the emergency department. So is it an older person? Is it somebody that's overbearing, that's answering all the questions? Noticing the psychosocial aspects of the patient themselves. Are they very submissive? Do they have poor eye contact? Do they not give information? And then identifying these folks and asking them key questions about their history. For example, substance abuse, for example, run-ins with police, abusive injuries in the past, and really kind of drilling down and asking these questions in private with them is really key to helping to identify these potential victims.
We're talking about how Michigan healthcare facilities are training to spot and care for victims of human trafficking. Our guests are Dr. Alan Jansen, Director of Emergency Medicine Residency, and Nicholas Evans, Vice President of Business Development. Both are with Genesis Health System in Genesee County. One more for you, Dr. Jansen. We think of an emergency room as a place where you depend on the staff to give you immediate treatment and attention, sometimes in life and death situations. But I understand that a trafficker might seek out the emergency room almost as an ideal place not to draw attention. Can you explain why and how that works?
Well, it is ideal potentially for some of these abusers for all the reasons you said. First of all, it's sometimes tough to track visits. So if you go to one emergency department for one thing and then the next time you go to another one or even the same emergency department with a different provider, it sometimes is a little more challenging to track patterns. Likewise, nobody necessarily asks you for money up front. Nobody verifies necessarily your demographic information. And as you said, emergency departments are busy places. So although all the medical providers really want to do the best they can, if you come in with a complaint that superficially seems to be rather simple, you might get that treated and nobody asks the next questions or nobody pushes a little bit more information. These are the things that we're trying to train medical professionals to do on the front end. So hopefully we can identify and provide assistance to these victims.
Well, does that mean your effort will double down on awareness raising in emergency room situations or settings?
Well, I think our awareness will, as will, and the other benefit is, of course, giving medical professionals a template by which, hey, if you see these things, maybe these are the next steps you should take.
Nick Evans, a few other hospital systems in the U.S. have pioneered human trafficking awareness. There's one in Wichita, Kansas, Via Christi. And Via Christi and Genesis are both part of what's called Ascension, the largest Catholic health system in the U.S. Via Christi has developed a four-step protocol for identifying human trafficking. Do you know much about that model? Is that something Genesis might incorporate?
Yeah, we actually have a steering committee that is going to start meeting in September when the grant becomes active. And yes, we will actually be benchmarking off Via Christi and have been speaking with their folks to help us in the development of this. And I think it's really important to highlight also that the part of the work we're doing is not proprietary to our health system or to Genesee County, but the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services really brought us into this because what the goal is really is to provide these benchmarking steps and these protocols out to every doctor's office, every urgent care, and every hospital to all implement that. And the goal really is to not provide any place where trafficked victims can be taken to be treated without the good chance that they're going to be identified. And the best way for this to take place is for us to really focus in on the individuals who are the traffickers and then to do everything we can to really try to protect the victims. Very often in these situations, as we've heard from law enforcement, sometimes specifically in the sex trade, sometimes the victims who are the individuals being put on the streets or who are being used are looked at as the criminals. And our focus really is to more be an advocate on their behalf but really go to the root problem and take away the marketplace and just make it as difficult as we can for this even to take place in our state.
We have been talking about human trafficking and what healthcare officials can do to identify and care for victims. Dr. Alan Jansen is Director of Emergency Medicine Residency, and Nicholas Evans is Vice President of Business Development. Both of them are with Genesis Health System in Genesee County. That organization is using a $50,000 state grant to combat human trafficking. Thanks to both of you. Current state on WKAR, just in time for Halloween, the Audio Air Force troupe comes to Robin Theater in Riotown, ready for their next and final production of 2016. It's a double bill of radio theater, including the campy horror of something called The Chicken Heart, plus a more traditional retelling of Bram Stoker's classic vampire story, Dracula. Current state's Jamie Paisley recently sat in on the first rehearsal and spoke with the troupe's founder, Dave Downing, as for what radio theater is.
I guess being that we're talking on WKAR, if you're not listening and supporting the Prairie Home Companion, especially now, you should be ashamed of yourself. So that's essentially what we're doing. It's called radio theater, or I guess the more modern term for it now is audio theater, and it encompasses a lot of things, like Prairie Home Companion, and there are a lot of organizations around the country that do essentially what we're trying to do here, which is do a live audio theater production on stage. And then we'll eventually, we'll record them, and then we'll eventually have them online. So we have actors that perform their lines on stage, and then on one side of the stage we'll have a person that will be doing the music portion live, and then we have somebody not as gifted vocally as they have on Prairie Home Companion. We use objects to make the sound. So there'll be a sound effects crew on the other side of the stage.
Now, this is an extension of what you did formerly you worked at LCC's radio station, WLNZ. When you departed LNZ, how long until you said, this is an itch that I need to be audio scratched?
Well, it actually goes back to maybe the early 80s when I started teaching audio theater in the media department. One of the instructors in the theater department had a class called Reader's Theater, which is where the actors sit around a table and read their lines, and they work on their emoting of their character without the use of, you know, their actions. So they can work on their lines and their voice and their inflection. So the instructor of Reader's Theater and I got together and hatched up an idea of doing audio theater. So I got some media students, and we set up a sound studio and brought the Reader's Theater students in, and then we had what we're essentially doing here, and we recorded it. So it was kind of a nice thing between two different departments of the college. So we did that for a lot of years, and then one year we decided that we would try to do that for the Silver Bells in the City, just do a radio drama Christmas play. And so we came up with some old scripts and did it. And they've been doing it. Last year was the 10th year that they did it. They keep doing it. So I kind of look at that as my legacy. So
I'm alone in the castle. I'm alone. I'm alone. I'm alone.
That was very good.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Dr. Seward. Mr. Harker's journal terminates at this point. I now present into evidence a clipping dated August of that year from the Yorkshire.
Now, you mentioned the scripts for this, and I know Dracula, that's a tale that's often retold, and that Lights Out, Chicken Heart. Lights Out is actually a program from the early 30s, I believe it is, and Chicken Heart was a program that was rather terror-inducing, which was rather appropriate for the time. Is the entirety of what Audio Air Force brings out into the community, is that scripts that have already been kind of proven as they've hit the airwaves?
Yes and no. We're going to be doing both recreations of traditional radio plays like Dracula and Chicken Heart. Both came out in 1938. And then the last production we did last month was an adaptation of a stage play, which is brand new, called Comrade's Mine, which is a story of Sarah Emma Edmonds, who during the Civil War disguised herself as a man, enlisted in the Army, and it was done more in the the tradition of a stage play in two acts, but we did it all audio theater, and it was actually quite nice. We didn't lose anybody during intermission, so I took that as a plus.
We're speaking with Dave Downing of the Audio Air Force Troop, who are presenting a double bill on Saturday, October 29th at the Robin Theater in Reotown, Lansing, at both 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. And Dave, I have a question about the content for both of these radio plays that are being presented, Dracula and The Chicken Heart. Are these all ages kinds of presentations, or given the scary nature of the stories, is there a recommended starting age for this double bill?
Well, Dracula can be pretty intense, so as far as the story goes. So I would say for kids, if they don't truly, totally understand the concept of vampires, then maybe it might be a little too intense for them. Chickenheart is, I don't know how seriously they took it back in 1938, but we're going to put a lot of cheese on it. So we're approaching it as overacting, and we're going to be actually making it like a B-movie, so as much as we can, and just have fun with it. The whole idea of doing The Chickenheart is to get people that are not, acquainted with audio theater an opportunity to experience it first before we get into the big production of Dracula. So
open the door, young man.
But I can't, sir. There's something holding the door back. You see? It's something soft, yielding, something living.
What?
I'm not crazy, sir. Listen. Put your ear against the door and listen.
By golly, I...
Please, sir, listen.
Yeah, I'll listen.
Now, this double bill is going to be on stage at the Robin Theater in Reotown. Is this the first production at the Robin, or how did that relationship with the owners, Dylan Rogers and Jana D. Allen, how did that partnership begin?
A year ago, on Halloween Eve, we did the anniversary of War of the Worlds, and we did the War of the Worlds script, and we did it at the Pump House, and it was more of in East Lansing. And it was more of an experiment to see, because we were just starting, if people would come out and see what we do.
Proof of concept.
No idea. So we had pretty good luck with Casablanca, the very first one we did the month before that. So we thought we would try War of the Worlds in October. And the Pump House, you know, holds like 50 people, and we were packed. People were standing outside on the lawn to listen to what we were doing. So we knew we had to find another place. And it just happened to be that a mutual friend of Dylan and myself introduced us to each other. So it was, you know, it just kind of clicked. And so last month we did Comrade's Mine, the first one. And so this month we're back, and then we'll be back in January. And we have, our goal is to do a production January, February, March and April, and then we're going to see where we are, and at that point, and see if, you know, how often we're going to do it and when we're going to do them. But we're considering Robin Theater our home base.
Dave Downing and the Audio Air Force present the Radio Theater Double Bill of Dracula and the Chicken Heart, Saturday, October 29th at 7 and 9 p.m. at the Robin Theater in Reotown, Lansing. Visit AudioAirForce.com for more information on the troupe or purchase tickets to either of Saturday's performances at TheRobinTheater.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, you know it's Michigan Week if you're an MSU football fan. Author and sports TV and radio host Jack Ebling has co-written a book about the thrilling final seconds of the MSU football victory over the Wolverines last season. It's called The Perfect 10. Current sports host Al Martin talks with Jack about the game's place in Spartan sports history. And it's Live Music Friday. We welcome Alex Mendenhall to our radio stage. He's a soul and folk songwriter and singer from Lansing who tours all over the country. He released his debut EP, Here to Stay, back in 2013. Now Alex is releasing his first full-length album, Into the Hinterland, with a release show at the Robin Theater in Riotown, set for November the 5th. That and more tomorrow on Current State. Our executive producer is Peter Wharf. Kevin Lavery directed today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. The Current State podcast features everything that you hear on our radio program. It's also all at our website, wkar.org. But get the podcast anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get fine podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State. See you tomorrow on Live Music Friday. Ooh.